Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Snacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Andrew on the board. S&P futures are up 64. NASDAQ futures up 266. So we're sort of back where we were yesterday about 2 o'clock before we had a little bit of a sell-off on the close. We were still up on the day. Pretty big after the sell-off of the day before, but we sold off some going into the close, and now we made that back, and we're heading back to the north here. We'll see how that goes after the big sell-off of 3 days. Is everybody's convinced, the talking heads, that it was a buying opportunity of a lifetime, and the Fed's going to save us. Don't worry. What do you think, Kevin? Don't worry.
What's there to worry about? The White Sox won, so you know there's nothing left to be for concern. No more causes for concern.
I was absolutely convinced that the Cubs were going to be the ones to lose to them.
Well, you remember when the Buccaneers started as an expansion team?
Yep.
And they I don't remember how many they lost, but it was the better part of 2 years before they won a game. And of course, everybody was terrified to be when they went down to when they played Tampa, terrified to be the team that gave them their first win after all of those losses to start the franchise's history.
Your bosom buddy was the coach.
They were actually in the process of becoming pretty good, so they were giving everybody a tussle, and everybody was playing them like it was the Super Bowl. And yeah, I'm sure everybody sort of felt that way about the White Sox. But, of course, the A's are probably the second worst team in baseball, so you never know what's going to happen then.
Your buddy was their coach, John McKay.
Yes, John McKay. Welcome. John McKay, despite the taint of evil from being from USC, he was actually pretty funny. And what's his all-time greatest line, Tom?
I don't know, but I know he got him the death penalty.
Absolutely. He got serious penalties for Southern Cal. That's and years later, Pete Carroll did the same thing, left ahead of the posse.
Well, the difference was the death penalty in those days meant no TV.
Yeah, meant no TV. It's sort of like what parents do to their kids.
Well, I recall, and of course everybody will, some history buffs might agree with me, but I actually went to a Notre Dame game where they couldn't know this before everybody was on Channel 5 and all that stuff, but they were, Southern Cal could not be on TV. And I don't even think that local Notre Dame guys could put them on. Maybe they did, but there was no, the difference in the game, the half was less than an hour. I mean, there were no TV timeouts. It was like 28 and a half now or something. There were no TV timeouts. The halftime was like, 15 minutes. And the game was over, whatever. It was started at 1:00. I think it was over at maybe 3:15.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
it was really pretty weird. It was like a grammar school game. Halftime, they each go down on one knee on each side of the field or something. And anyway, the
two hours is a great time frame for a sporting event. That's why I like going to college basketball games so much. They're generally over in 2 hours.
Well, here's a little ditty here. They say a little ditty about Jack and I.
Jack and Diane, yeah.
Yeah. A little ditty. This was a testimony in front of Congress. The American public was determined to speculate. They were determined that every piece of paper would be more tomorrow than twice tomorrow what it was today. I do not believe the whole banking community could have prevented it. But it had taken full sway of the people. There was an absolute runaway feeling throughout the country I doubt whether anyone could have stopped it before calamity overtook us. I call it panic to be afraid to sell at a profit, lest an additional profit be lost. The panic which keeps people at roulette tables, the insidious propaganda against quitting a winner, the fear of being taunted by those who held on, all worked together. It became not only a point of pride, but of civic duty not to sell, as if there was ever a buyer without a seller. Testimony after a crash at 29. Does it sound familiar?
Yeah, it does sound familiar. Hey, but before you get away, you gotta go with the John McKay quote.
Yeah. Well, what was it?
When he was at Tampa, and they were in this long losing streak after one of the games, some media creature asked him how he felt about his offense's execution, and he said I'm in favor of it.
Yeah. Well, who was the big quarterback that they had drafted? They had somebody down there.
Williams, what was his first name?
Doug.
Doug Williams, yeah. So Doug Williams was one of them. Their first ever draft pick was Ricky Bell.
He was a good player.
Yeah, he was a very good player from USC.
We'll go figure. He drafted somebody from USC.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
Selman, Leroy Salmon.
Yeah.
Was one of their early stars. So yeah, they had a lot going for them. It's just nobody wanted to be the first. And you know, honestly, I should, because I bring it up, I should remember this. But I have no idea who the first loss, who did get tagged with that first loss.
Well, I know everybody when they played the '62 Mets, it was nobody wanted to lose. They were. It turns out they're not as bad as the White Sox are in terms of, well, the Sox could rally here, but right now they're on a pace to lose more than the '62 Mets, right?
It's impressive. It's impressive that they could lose so much when they weren't trying to tank.
Well, I mean, they when you started the 2 years ago, they were somewhat of a, I won't say a favorite, but they were in the not only the playoff hunt, they were in the, you know, the go deep in the playoff hunt. But you look at it, third baseman disappeared, right? I don't know, he got hurt and whatever. Shortstop disappeared. Those are, and the kid from the Cubs is long gone. So those three people were supposed to be like all stars.
Yeah,
and they're not even there.
The foundation of their team, and they for various reasons they never happened, mostly injuries. But they just genuinely suck now. I mean, they have nothing going for them.
Center fielder and a one pitcher, and they paid up through the nose for the guy in left field, and he's just average, right?
Yeah. Well, and he never was better than that. When they got him, he wasn't better than that.
They got a couple of guys that are decent. The first baseman's good, and there's a couple of guys. I mean, it's not like they're all horrible, but
the first baseman?
Well, I don't even the left-handed know. Guy. He's been there for a while.
It's Vaughn. He's not left-handed.
All right, Vaughn. He's not bad.
Oh, he's okay. He's average.
Yeah. But, I mean, they have some players that would play other places. A center fielder surely would. I have no idea who's playing second.
Well, they were hoping to deal him at the deadline, but that would be selling low. So
yeah.
he's not having a good season, and he's spent too much time on the injured list over the last few years. So their big hope for Luis Robert, if they want to get anything for him, is that he has a hot last 2 months and they can trade him in the offseason.
Yeah, but isn't the guy like 25 or 27? He's young.
He's pretty young still, yeah.
The pitcher they're trying to dump is 25. Right?
Well, they were hoping to totally fleece somebody, and maybe they will at some point. But of course, the reason they couldn't in that case was that he's had his surgeries and he's back from it, but he wants to cap his innings this year, or. So that he can preserve his future earning opportunities. And I don't blame him for that. So he said anybody who acquires him would have to give him a contract extension or he's not going to pitch in the postseason.
Well, there you go.
That made him not very tradable.
Because
who's going to pick him up? A contender is going to want to pick him up, so...
Well, you'd hope to give the guy a contract. I mean,
well, yeah, but this is his first. This is the first healthy season he's had. He's been around,
yeah,
about 3-4 years, and this is the first healthy season he's had. So, what are you going to do with that? You know, are you going to are you going to say, okay, I'll give you a contract extension? That's a big bet. So, you know, nobody wants to do an extension, or, you know, frankly, I think he's under contract next year. Nobody wants to do anything until they see that he can actually pitch for any length of time.
Well,
and stay healthy.
I think somehow or another, this idea that every one of these kids has to be max throwers at every pitch. And look at the guys on the Cubs, the young guys that are out this year. I mean, the one kid, Brown, I mean, I thought he was terrific. And the real big guy, Little, the left-handed guy, I mean, how many people do they have out?
Little is out, and Alzolay, they just announced, is going to be done for the season. He's going to have surgery. They got a lot of guys out injured, and yet their pitching is still pretty good. But I think we mentioned this last week, is that, you know, maybe the model for some of these teams is going to be to find more guys who pitch in the style of a Kyle Hendricks of a few years ago, or Shota, Imanaga, or, you know, guys like that that aren't maxing out every single time, and maybe they're going to have more longevity as a result,
and
be more reliable over the course of a season.
Well, when my buddy, his kid's been in the travel baseball forever. Evidently, they had a big, I don't know if you want to call it a tournament, a meet, whatever, they were down at Notre Dame, right? So they actually stayed at the St. Mary's Inn. So it was pretty nice. The Inn at St. Mary's.
And, yeah, I've stayed there once before I moved here, a long time ago. But
their baseball coach was pontificating, and he basically told him if the kid can't throw 90 miles an hour, they don't want him. Well, okay. So he wouldn't want Greg Maddux? Well, Greg Maddux could throw 90 miles an hour, but wasn't much over that. So he'd say no to Greg? Say no to Warren Spahn? And really. Oh, you know what I had here for you, and I was going to dig it out, and I could not. Well, I could not. I know it's buried someplace in my voluminous crap. They did some study. Who had the most effective fastball in the last, I don't know, I won't say Major League history, because nobody, in like the last 30 years?
Not the best. Most effective fastball.
Not the best. The most effective.
Define effective for me.
People had no chance of hitting it. In terms of whenever they were thrown, it was a terrific pitch.
Probably Randy Johnson.
No, I didn't say best. Most effective. Yeah,
I understand, but he was pretty damned effective, too.
Would you believe Tim Wakefield?
Oh, okay, I get it, yeah. Because he was a knuckleball guy, it was such a surprise every time he threw a fastball.
And it was like 75 miles an hour. Yeah. But the knuckleball was, what, 68 or something? Or was it 70 and 78 or something? And all of a sudden when he threw it, guys were mystified. How wild is that?
Again, pitching, you know, more than anything else, look, it's wonderful if you can overpower people. But not only is that hard on the arm and it makes you injury prone, but in addition to that, as soon as you start to lose it a little bit, your career takes a quick slide downhill. Aroldis Chapman is an example. He's still pitching, and he's still pretty good, but he's not the guy he was several years ago.
Well, I go back to
like that because he's lost a few miles an hour, and if you're a one-trick pony, all you can do is blow people away. Sooner or later, that goes away. But if you know the craft of pitching, you can have a very, very long career.
The first guy I noticed that late in his career, the Cubs acquired Goose Gossage. I don't know if you recall. You probably do. And he was all right for a little bit, but then he kind of just blew up on the Cubs. And I'm sitting there thinking, this guy needs to do something else. He's still got the fastest pitch on the team, but because that's all he's got, people are nailing him. If he had any kind of other pitch, he'd still be fine. But he didn't. Or he must have had something, yeah, but he didn't. You know what I'm saying? Just what you're saying. I mean, he developed. Well, now, Hendricks this year, I mean, the last eight starts, he's been pretty effective. Evidently, now he's developed a curveball, which he never really had before, which evidently is very effective.
Well, yeah. So, you have multiple pitches, so they don't know what's coming. And, of course, you have to have command of the strike zone. But then we throw on top of that that you move the ball around, you keep people off balance. They don't, you know, you're up and down, you're in and out, you know, those kinds of things. And if you watched Imanaga pitch last night, and he was terrific. He had 10 strikeouts. And I don't think he ever, he might have gotten to 94 or 95 at a couple of pitches, but that's not what he does mostly. He just does it by keeping people off balance. And, you know, I will not be surprised if some team says I'm going to build a whole staff or most of my staff around that kind of an approach, because I can't afford to have, you know, all of my pitchers going out. I can't afford to have lose guys for full seasons with Tommy John surgery. And I think they're going to be looking for alternatives.
Plus, those guys can go seven innings instead of five, which is amazingly different for your bullpen.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that much different. How's this for Segre? It's not that much different than having a stock market that requires that relies on seven stocks, and when one or two of those start to lose their juice, what happens to the market?
Well, yeah, I have a somewhere buried in here. I'll find it on a break, but I have a quote in here. It's exactly that. It has to do with all these other stocks. Only a few stocks are going up, and the rest of them aren't. And it's all from like 1929. It's pretty scary. I'm reading this book. The book is 1929, the year of the great crash. William Klingemann. But you know, the things that always is involved, and that's one of the things right now, Kevin, that I don't think some of these stocks are incredibly high priced, in my opinion, historically incredibly high priced. Okay, the big stocks, I mean, big companies that really can't double unless they engulf the world, are trading for, you know, 13 times revenue, which I've never seen before. But doesn't mean it, you know, the company can't grow into it. But also, we have the variable we talked about last Friday of the Fed, you know, constantly putting more money in. So yeah, the stock may stay at that price, but the dollars you're valuing it with are actually going down in price. So it's a phenomenon that is relatively new, at least in this country. It wasn't in the Weimar Republic. It wasn't in Turkey, where we poured money in the system and the stock market went way up in their currency. Now, therein lies the rub. But I think it comes down a lot to margin. I mean, you really didn't have any problems with the tulip craze until people could borrow, right? Well, one of the little-known facts about the 1929 crash or the market in that era is you essentially bid for your margin. You bid for the ability to get margin money by paying up for the margin price. There was sort of like a mini crash on March 26th of 1929. And as the day wore on, people couldn't buy because nobody would give them the margin. And the margin got bid up to like 20% interest by the afternoon, because people were willing to pay 20% interest just because they thought the stocks were such a bargain down there, sort of like, you know, the other night. Oh man, I'll pay 20% interest to buy this dip. You know, that type of thing. You could actually do that back then. And the companies that dove in to take the margin, the banks said no mas. So your companies like GM, GE, and all those places, they got in the margin loan business because it was 15, 20%. So a lot of the money that was lost by these big companies during the crash was not just they weren't selling any cars, they lost money on stock margin loans. Can you imagine that? I mean, but then again, if somebody's paying 20%, there's going to be some dude that's going to lend it to him, right?
Always.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, you know, going on in the markets today, and I did read, and I'm not, boy, I'm sure as hell not. I don't know if I'm right now. I'm deciding whether it's you or Lou I'm voting for, but I was somewhat relieved when I read Harris's portfolio background. And she's basically all in just passive ETFs and has been forever. You know, I wish, and I can't accuse anybody of anything because you don't really know what's in their mind, but I really wish I didn't have to deal with Biden's strings into Ukraine. I really didn't wish I had to have to deal with Trump's, you know, bailout a couple times by Russian people buying his condos. And I really didn't have to wish that I didn't have to wish with Bush's affinity for the oil industry and why we went into Iraq. I mean, I don't know enough to accuse people of that. Who knows where Obama's ties were, but I just don't like it, Kevin. I mean, I don't know how much of it is how much it clouds their judgment, how much it doesn't. I just know if I was a lawyer and I knew the judge got a bunch of money from State Farm, and State Farm was, it was against State Farm in that courtroom, I just wouldn't like it. I'm not saying that the judge couldn't say, well, that was then and this is now. In this case, I'm a judge now. I mean, who knows? The guy could be, you know, he could be purer than Pharaoh's wife, you know, but I just don't like it, you know. And I don't know, that's just me. What can I say? Just saying.
Well, you, what can you say? You already said it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean that I'm going to vote for the lady, but it does mean, I was sort of relieved to see that, though. Just saying. I mean, doesn't mean she has any business in the other, you know.
You're going to love Tim Walz's engagement with Chinese companies.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So here, before I go anywhere, now there's the other guys. Of course, I think it's pretty easy to. I don't know. Well, think of this, Kevin. How could you not have been engaged with Chinese companies 10 years ago? I mean, it's all we talked about.
Yeah, but Tom, it depends on whether. Are you talking about investment or are you talking about personal involvement?
Well, but so. There's going to be. I'll tell the story real quick again. I went to one of these Economic Club of Chicago dinners when I was in the club. And the reason why I'm not in the club is when Jim Tyree died, he was my date. The guy from the terrific man from he ran Mesro, died young. Anyway, he was my date. So if I wasn't going with him, I didn't want to go pay, you know, $250 for dinner and stand there in my tux and try and meet somebody. Anyway, one night I'm sitting there at the table, and well, they didn't have tables. When you went to the cocktail thing, they had to stand up things. So all you had to do is get a table, because there weren't enough. Be the first person there and immediately had people to talk to, because they would come stand next to you, because they wanted a table to put their drink down too. So I'm talking to this lady who actually worked for the Chinese consulate. And I said, okay, what does somebody want to do if all of a sudden they feel they have to go over there with their clients? You know, maybe they're... We just had somebody on the show regarding... he did coatings, don't call them Teflon, coatings for pots and pans. And the pots and pans people had moved to China, so in order for him to be essentially their customer, he had to be close. They're not going to ship the pots and pans back to West Chicago to get coated. He had to do it over there. So he was thinking of going over there, or he had gone over there. And anyway, she says, oh, yeah, if you want to do that, you come see us. We'll figure out what kind of business it is. We'll help you out. We'll get you, like, your guy. Meaning somebody from the, I guess, Communist Party.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
so Mike Greco used to write about having a Chinaman.
Yeah, yeah. So then
this was literally.
Yeah, without Chinaman. So so they would find you the spot, and I guess if you give them enough dough, they kept their finger on labor and all the other stuff. And, but I mean, everybody for a long period of time kind of was forced into that. I mean, I used to tell the joke all the time when John and I were on the score. I forget who even was president at the time. How would you feel if you're in the Oval Office and all of a sudden Bill Gates, you know, before he became whatever he is now, Bill Gates walks in and says, hey, I've sold these idiots, you know, or they've bought three things of software, and there's 100 million computers over there all running my stuff. I think they probably stole it, right? Duh. And you're sitting there, oh, man, I got to do something with China. All of a sudden the next guy walks in and it's Yum Brands or Coca-Cola. What are you talking about? There's a billion people drinking a Coke every day. There's more. Actually, at one point, weren't there more pictures of the Colonel from Kentucky Fried than there were a mile? So, I mean, it was. It's such a how anybody during that period of time didn't have something to do over there. I don't know how you. I mean, somehow or another, that's where everything went. Why do you think the jobs are screwed up here?
I understand wanting. I mean, the big thing is, you know, people will go for cheap labor. I think you have to draw some lines there.
Oh, I do too.
On that, and I've all, you know, and that's not new. That, you know, that was true then. It's true now, and it's important. But aside from that, I do understand wanting to sell into the Chinese market. It's huge.
Yep.
So you definitely, you know, you do want access to the market. Anybody that can handle that kind of scale would want to be in there. So I understand that, but then you have to start asking, okay, what's the cost? What is it? What are there compromises I have to make to do that, or or can I, you know, can I really just operate my business ethically as I sell over there? And if you can answer that question as a positive, then knock yourself out and sell it. But do you really have to, you know, if you have to bend knee to the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, you do.
Well, I know you do. Yeah. Then is it worth it? You know, when do you sell your soul? And I think a lot of people have just, you know, sort of said, well, it's the cost of doing business. But there's other people who say, well, then I'm not doing business.
Well, we have an interesting story, actually from last night. We come back from break. S&P futures up 60, NASDAQ futures up 252. It has to do with pollution and just what you're talking about, Kevin. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe, Andrew on the board. S&P futures are up 61. NASDAQ futures up 251. So you're trying to take a big chunk out of the 3 days we were down. We were going to do that yesterday, and we were up huge most of the day, and then we still ended up with a pretty good day. But we sold off 80 spook points in like the last hour or two. We still were up some. I'll give you exactly what we were up. We still were up 53 in the S&Ps. NASDAQ was up 166. Dow was up 294. But the S&P was up 110 most of the day, and NASDAQ was up, well, I'm going to say 280. So we did sell off, even though it was up, you know, it still was a really good day. A big bounce day. DAX up 207, 1.2%. FTSE up 91, 1.1%. CAC around up 120, 1.7. They're the leader over there. Everybody with the big bounce. They didn't bounce back hardly at all yesterday, but today they are. Over in Asia, the Nikkei up 414, 1.1%. They're almost back to where they were before the 12% drop, but that's not healthy, 12% drops. Hang Seng, but a big bounce, up 230, 1.4%. Still can't make it back to 17,000. 16,877. Shanghai, only up 2, 28,69. So they're not participating so much today. Bonds, up 4 basis points, 3.93. As everybody's calling for the Fed to cut rates, the last 2 days of 10 years had a big rally. So there you go with that. The Bund up 9 basis points, 2.28. Japan unchanged, 0.89. Oil, a little bit of a bounce finally, up $1.27, $74.47. It got down under $73. It was 82 maybe 2 weeks ago. Brent down up $1.30, $77.80. Natural gas up 4 cents, $2.05. RBOB up a penny, $2.33. Gold up 650, 2438, bouncing back a little bit. Silver, not so. Silver's unchanged, still 2721. It was up maybe a month ago, and it was like 30. So silver's down like 10%. Copper down 5 cents, 397. Not sure that's been under 4 for quite a while, but now it is. We have the foreign exchange, which caused a lot of this. Euro steady at 109. British pound steady at 127. Japanese yen back to 147. Now that was 163 to 143. Now 147. A 2% move today in the yen. And I'm going to say to Kevin and Russell in a bit, 2 and 3% moves in a currency is not healthy. Something's wrong someplace. Don't know what it is. That's my suspicion. Bitcoin up 416, 57,155. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. That's a lot of stuff.
All right, yeah. Don't have as much over here. It is 6:37 here in Chicago on Wednesday, August 7th. Starting off with a little bit of sports. The Cubs have won over the Twins, 7-3. And as was mentioned before, the White Sox finally broke their 21-game losing streak, and the White Sox won over the Athletics 5-1. Finally, the Diamondbacks were going to play the Guardians yesterday, but that was postponed due to rain, and they'll be making that up with a doubleheader later today. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 71 degrees. We're going to have a high of 77 today. We can expect a little bit of mix of clouds and sunshine, and hopefully this looks like the start of a week with a little bit more comfortable weather coming up. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 84 degrees. As always, things are going to be sunny with maybe a little bit of clouds here and there, but they're going to have a high of 105 today. And finally, for Chicago traffic, there are thankfully no... Actually, change that. Looks like an accident just appeared on the inbound Kennedy. This is right before East Illinois 64 North Avenue. Involving a motorcycle, expect delays up to 20 minutes around there. But other than that, traffic is building on the inbound expressways. Looks like no other major accidents to report. So that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Kevin, if you'll indulge me here for a quick second. I'm talking about the March 26, 1929, which was the kind of the precursor to October. The wave of liquidation became a flood on the morning of March 26, the night before. Brokers had sent out hundreds of margin calls, demands for more collateral to replace the vantage value of stocks that had been used as collateral, but whose price had abruptly declined. When many harried investors proved unable to provide additional security, their stocks was dumped on the market for whatever they could bring. Amateur speculators panicked, overwhelmed by the avalanche of falling prices. The morning smash was one of the widest on record. Reported one observer, stock drops like plummets from 5 to 17 points with no visible signs of support. Thousands of accounts were wiped out in the His violent swing and many thousands of speculators, on their own volition, a stage bordering panic, committed financial hairy-carry. Every brokerage house in New York and throughout the country was jammed to the doors with excited customers. But here's the weird part. Meanwhile, the desperate demand for cash created a severe credit stringency. Interest rates for call money, meaning margin money, mounted hourly to 15% and 18% before finally peaking at 20%, their highest rate in 9 years, at 1:30 in the afternoon. At that prohibitive rate, potential buyers were severely discouraged from bolstering the falling market. The rush to turn stocks into cash peaked so hysterical that the ticker fell 90 minutes behind. So they would actually bid out for the margin money in those days. Isn't that wild?
It is crazy.
What were we talking about right before the break, before I dug into that and lost my train of thought?
Yeah, we were talking about the ethics of doing business in China.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk about the story about my buddy Bill last night was telling me he was on the board of the Ranch Triangle, which is the area where I live, and they had this recycling facility, General Iron, and people were lined up, you know, with all this scrap iron and scrap everything else, and they would have, once in a while, they'd have an explosion or something. But they had some pollution, but it was pretty amazing in that industry. You see all these pickup trucks and stuff, and people bringing all these cars. They'd bring all cars that were all squashed and everything, they'd bring them over to this place. And when they left, there was this huge truck with all these pellets of iron in there. And my guys that are architects tell me, you can actually use that recycled iron for just about everything. Bridge girders, they put it through the same process. I said, well, it's just, it's scrap crap. He goes, it's way better than iron ore. He goes, what are you starting with iron ore? How dirty is iron ore? He goes, it's way better. You can make bridge girders, everything out of there if you do, if you know what you've got and what your specs are. But anyway, he said this guy, walked down, they were having coffee at the, you know, one of the coffee shops in Armitage. The guy walked out, he had a white glove, and he was running, ran it across one of the windowsills in Armitage. He said, "See that?" He looked at it real close, it had like a magnifying glass. He goes, "That's metal. That's coming from General Iron. That that was actually the metal in the air." But here's where I think you're going, Kevin, and I think you are. We are offloading all this stuff. I mean, there's massive steel scrap that goes to China to be reprocessed. We actually mine a lot of what do they call the rare earth metals here. We ship them there to be processed because it's a dirty process. I mean, we're offloading our pollution. I mean, it's one thing to say, I mean, everybody wants stuff recycled, right? Nobody wants it in their backyard. I mean, this particular place, the city said, okay, we're going to get you out of Lincoln Park, where everybody's bitching. We'll move you to the south side. So, of course, when it gets to the south side, everybody's down there. What are we, chopped liver? Why do you want this place by us? Of course, the new facility probably was going to be cleaner. I don't know. But they want it. But nobody wants, wait a minute, you're getting booted out of one place. You're not coming anywhere near me. I mean, so the place, they never reopened. Even though the city gave them a permit, they closed them down in one spot and said, don't worry, we're going to open you up some other place. And then they didn't. And now, you know, but we still, but if you ask everybody, should you recycle? Well, hell yeah. So I mean, where do we land on this? You know, we don't want any child labor in this country, but oh, by the way, we don't want to pay anybody anything. So if they got 12-year-olds working in China, we ship our crap over there. I mean, this is what Carl's always talking about. I mean, where's the moral here?
There is no morality to it. And it is at best willful ignorance, but in reality, there's no ignorance involved in it. You know, especially when you're talking about large corporations. Like if you have a 100 employee manufacturing operation and you're importing parts from China or something, you're probably not making a lot of trips over to China. Somebody has set you up, you know, a freight forwarding company, somebody like that has set you up with the arrangements and you have it. But you can't tell me that a major corporation that does millions, maybe even billions of dollars worth of business with a producer in China doesn't send somebody with, you know, a VP or better title over there once in a while to meet the people involved and to see what's going on and kind of kick the tires. Sorry, you can't tell me that that doesn't happen. They know damn well what they're buying into here, and yet they do it anyway. And you know, somewhere along the line, you know, there needs to be at least enough accountability that says, you know, we don't do business with people like that. Period. That's not who we are. I don't care how good the deal is.
Well, you could certainly pin. I had an article at the time, but everybody else on the show was raging so much on the COVID situation that I kind of only mentioned it maybe once. But I had I'm sure it's buried somewhere in here now, but a situation that a lot of your big companies that do a lot of business in China, long before anybody here even knew about it, they knew there was some huge outbreak of something in Wuhan province. And we probably learned pretty quick, but they learned even more. And the amount of executives here, employees, for lack of a better term, that were still charged with going over there and coming back. I mean, the amount of people going back and forth to China back before the COVID was astronomical, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. You couldn't barely get a spot on a plane. And these people knew there was a problem over there. And a lot of those people that came back, and probably would have got here anyway, those are people who brought it back. They went over there, oh, no, go over to Wuhan. There's no problem. The other was, duh. I mean, this is like the, you know, the morality, and that's why, you know, people like Carl and me to a lesser extent are in industries where you see this. Some people get to do whatever they want and the dumbest decisions, and even if it hurts other people, everything's fine. And other people, the minute they do anything, somebody's crawling up their behind. And I don't know, somehow, Kevin, you would think, you know, it's always been like that to a certain extent, right? I mean, but it seems like maybe it's because we're hearing more about it or something, but it's somewhat out of control.
If we're hearing more about it, then that's a product of the information age, and I say good. You know, we should shine a light on all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, then there are people that do this who dismiss it and say, hey, it's always been going on, and you know, you cited it, but you weren't dismissing it. There are people who will dismiss it and say, always been that way, we just know more about it now. Well, okay, good. It's a good thing that we know more about it. How about we do something about it?
Well, I had a, this year, you can't argue at your own compliance meeting, right, Kevin? Our compliance guy, he's, you know, he's former FINRA, and now he's in a job. He helps firms like us out, keeping them up with compliance and so forth. So we have our compliance meeting, you know, whenever it was, February, January, you got to have one every year. We're sitting there, and now the new step forward was be careful with your recommendations. And you're like, what are you talking about? No, seriously, Tom, if you're sitting in a bar, not that I ever do, or at a library or a coffee shop, and somebody knows you're in the industry, and you say, guy says to you, what do you think about IBM? And you say, well, it's down kind of low, they're making some money, I kind of like the stock. He goes, don't do that. That's considered a recommendation. I go, what are you talking about? I'm talking to a guy in a bar. No. I said, he's not even a client. I'm not putting the trade in for him. I'm not even profit. It doesn't matter. You're a registered person. Now he can say you gave him advice. All right, well, as stupid as that sounds, it's probably true. Now, yesterday, somebody, some big firm comes out and tells everybody to go buy CrowdStrike. Well, how can they do that on TV, and I can't even do it in a bar to somebody I know? Yet, you know, now CrowdStrike's up. Kevin, I don't know whether you should buy it or not sell CrowdStrike. All I know is the lawsuits aren't even landing yet. How the hell can you put that recommendation out there? You know, then somebody else came out, then two people yesterday. The market is an absolute buy here. You know, put your money up. Don't you know, make sure you put more money to work today. The Fed's going to come and save us probably before the next meeting, but definitely then, and everything's all okay again. How does somebody know what's in the Fed's mind for the next meeting? How can somebody say that? And yet I'm sitting there in a compliance meeting, and I can't mention to you in a bar, I kind of like IBM. I mean, really?
That's a good hypothetical, though, because nobody likes IBM.
You know, it's been one of the hottest stocks this year, actually, out of the blue. I mean, it's almost up to 200. It's 180.
Oh, I see what you did, out of the blue.
Yeah, there you go. But, I mean, this constant, I mean, Carl's right. I mean, he's, you know, Carl can get a little too Carl. But the fact is, when you start to have laws that you only enforce once in a while, they're not laws, they're weapons.
Yeah, I agree. I 100% agree with that.
Now, how do we back off of that? I mean, how do you? We have a presidential choice that's 50-50. I'm not real, whatever. But I mean, is there a chance that either one is before they get into office is gonna go see the Penguin like in the Blues Brothers and see the light? How much of this stuff has to change? I don't think. Everybody's so worried about getting into office, I don't think they even have a chance to figure out what the hell they're going to do when they get there.
Yeah, we're good at bread and circuses, Tom, and that's probably the biggest thing that allows this to continue is that, you know, allows for the status quo is that, you know, we don't have enough well-informed people, and we don't have enough well-educated people who understand how things work, and so as a result, we just kind of forge on and let's see what the Kardashians are doing this week.
Well, there was a big study came out yesterday. I was listening on the radio that the Chicago school system, which I think they're up to, I could be a year or two behind. I think they're up to $20,000 or $21,000 a kid in the high schools. That's how much money follows the kid to that high school if he shows up there to go to school, he or she. And it doesn't include the capital. In other words, the cost of keeping the building. Mm-hmm. And I think the charter schools, what they get the $21,000, but then whoever is running the charter school has to provide the building, or the donors or whoever, the foundation has to provide the building and plant equipment, for lack of a better term. Now, so this account came out and said the Chicago Public Schools are $1.2 billion short and what it would take to really do a good job in education. I'm thinking, Kevin, where exactly now? I think the job is being done horribly. Now there are some really good, obviously, magnet schools and all those kinds of things. The technical schools seemingly have fallen apart. I don't see, I mean, I wouldn't give this Chicago public school system a D paper, let alone, I mean, I guess that won't be so nasty to say they get an F, but because a lot of it's family, a lot of it's community, a lot of the other stuff it's causing problems. But I'm gonna be somewhere in the C and D range. How exactly does splashing $1 billion on it, where do I even put it that all of a sudden I change it? I mean, what are we talking about here? Are we putting in the teacher's pension fund? Are we just giving everybody a raise to do whatever the hell it is they're doing?
I think if you give everybody a raise, they'll do better.
I mean, are we going to open up the technical schools?
Does that make any sense when you think about it?
Well, if we had the Tilden Techs of the world, those places, CVS, if we had them up and running to where they were doing this technical stuff there, I mean, teach people to weld, electricians, teaching people how to, you know, if you wanted to be a seamstress, I mean, whatever you wanted to be. You know, I'm not saying the seamstress are women. It could be some guy who's, I'm sure there's a lot of guys, seamstresses, working in Milan, making a lot of money. Well, they wouldn't be a seamstress. They'd be, what's a male seam guy? What's a male sewer or a guy who makes clothes? I don't even know. Anyway.
A clothes maker,
a suit maker. If those places are up and running, how easy would it to be, you know, and I'm not saying they should be here or not here, how easy would it be to shove 100 migrant people into those classes when everybody else left the school? If with all this federal money, wouldn't you think it would be a hell of a lot better if Tilden Tech was still open and every night when the kids left at 3:30, from 3 to 11, you had classes for not just the migrants but anybody, any other adult who wanted to learn how to do something and better themselves, sort of like what you guys are doing. I mean, that's what we should be doing, right? And so, where else are we pissing the money away?
Well, a lot of it is we developed the mentality, and it was really a big linchpin of the Obama administration as much as anything. And I'm not saying this with evil intent. I think it was misguided, but the feeling that everybody should go to college. Well, maybe everybody should go to college at some point in their life, and I'm certainly a fan of lifelong learning and so on. So I'm not dismissing that. But the idea that everybody should go get a bachelor's degree from a career standpoint is just folly. It's not a good economic deal for a lot of people, and it's certainly, you know, from an educational standpoint, has wasted a lot of dollars. So, you know, from my perspective, a lot of career oriented training is in order and is what we should be doing. And I'm obviously a big fan of it, and I'm kind of immersed in it. And yet I still get my business students. I still get, you know, my more standardized college students as well. So I'm not dismissing the importance of it. What I'm just saying is not everybody should go to college. It's an expensive gambit to get there. We poured so much money into that system that, like everything else, when you have more dollars chasing the same demand, it just bids up the price. So all we've done is really make college expensive, more overly expensive as a result of that. So it isn't even a good deal for the people who should be going to college. This is where we are. We've just done a really good job of being stupid and being stupid and building stupidity around our education system, which seems a little nutty, doesn't it?
Well, it is, and I, you know, you and I argue about this a little bit, and the reason why we do is I take it back to our day, which of course, you know, it's too freaking long ago, but in my family, you know, like my mother was huge on education, and so was yours. I remember your mom, and even if, you know, my stepfather would have owned a metalworking company, and I loved it and knew how to work the machines and everything else, and that's what I was going to do, come back and run the metalworking company, my mom still would have said, well, you're 17, you go to Notre Dame, you come back when you're 21, you're going to see the world a little bit, the world being South Bend. And by the way, you're going to be way better geared up in terms of what you're going to knowledge in running this place. You're going to do a better job for yourself, the employees, and everybody else. And by the way, it's only $3,000 a year rather than two something or whatever it was, other than $70,000 a year. I don't think it was an either or, but you're right. It has become an either or, and it shouldn't be.
Well, and some people are not adaptable to college. They're either not prepared or not inclined.
Well, yeah, I mean, if I was,
and so we've been telling them that they should be in college too. Right. I do see this. I see students who come in and they generally don't do well. And the only reason they're there is that, you know, they think they're supposed to be.
They come out of high school.
And so they tend not to do very well. That's not a good thing. Whereas if they went out and went to work for a little while, or if they came in with more of a career orientation to their education, or their educational goals, it might apply. You know, I tell guidance counselors routinely, I said, send me, you know, I love getting your A students, they're great, you know, they're easy to teach, and they're a lot of fun, but send me your C students. You know, your C students, they don't have to get an associate's degree, they don't have to get any degree, but what I can do for them is I can get them through a certificate curriculum, I can get them a whole bunch of industry-recognized certifications in the process, and so in a year's time, I can get them, you know, I can get them out into the world of work. I can have them on a fast track, you know, at 18, 19 years old, they're sitting on a fast track to be a supervisor, you know, team lead, one of those kind of roles in manufacturing or warehousing or transportation, any of those supply chain types of industries. And then if they're ready, when they're ready,
you're just talking about
then,
a different phase.
That's when we say, okay, come back. Come on back in, and we'll start working on the next phase of your education.
You're talking about just a different pace, is all you are. My mom couldn't go to college.
Some people are never going to get that second, you know, that extra pace.
Well, but if it was me, if I just went right to work in the factory, and all of a sudden I get a little more responsibility, and I'm tired of talking to the finance people, and I have no idea what the hell they're talking about. Maybe it's time for me to come see Kevin. Hey, I do need an accounting course because I don't know what the hell they're talking about. And some people only really like to do stuff when there's a need for it. I'm not pinning them down. I'm saying, well, all of a sudden now we need to, we used to do a lot of this stuff. There was a place up where you guys used to live, Kevin. What was it? Remember the Holiday Inn with the big swimming pool, the dome swimming pool on the Kennedy? They were hooked into the American Management Group or something, where they would have these 2 and 3 week intensive classes. Like if you wanted to get, if all of a sudden you're working your way up the chain to where you're helping the people out in sales, and you go, wait a minute, if I'm in the same room with these guys, I got to know the lingo. At least I know what these guys are talking about. You could take a 2 or 3 or 4 week intensive training thing in marketing or something, and get a certificate. It gets you to the same place, is what I'm saying.
And it's one thing to get the certificate from the college, and that, you know, that'll be, depending on the school and depending on what's going on, that'll be recognized to some extent. And it's certainly a credential. It's a good thing. But when you tack on that, industry group of significance that you pass their certification exam as well, and you have all of these line items on your resume, you know, we've actually done something, and it's a very practical and useful type of education that's going to help people have a better job and therefore a better life. That is, you know, to me, is where the educational system needs to be. And then for those who want to go to, and get a bachelor's degree, whether it's as a commuter or whether it is going away to school, and following that somewhat traditional route, you know, then you have choices. But that's not the idea that everybody should make that choice
I'm saying right now I see immigrants, not just there because they're most visible, but kids in a lot of these neighborhoods in gangs and God knows what else they're doing. I see 3 or 4 technical schools that I know of, and I'm sure there's a bunch that I don't even know about, essentially with no students during the day, and they're closed at night. And who knows if they even have the equipment anymore. And I see my nephew and all the people here that are trying to do, steel working and those kinds of things, and making stuff for other people's big machines, making all the parts. I see them scrambling all over the place to hire people. Those three things all together kind of suck, Kevin. Just saying.
Yeah, well, we're not meeting the needs. You know, ultimately, that's supposed to be what the educational system is doing. And that's not what we support with education dollars from government. We're supposed to fill the needs of the community, and we're not doing that.
We don't even want to. We don't even attempt to do it. It's kind of nuts. So, our Cubs. I wouldn't throw the towel in on those guys just yet. I mean, they have the pitching that they could possibly, if they could score four runs a night, they could win 10 games in a row. I'm not saying they'll go too far in the playoffs, but they've got some improvement going there. That kid in center field gets better by the day.
They have improved. Well, some guys are just starting to hit, you know, more like they have historically. And that's baseball, right? It happens all the time in baseball. People have bad half seasons. People have bad whole seasons. But most people wind up somewhere around their historical norm. It's a long season. It's a big sample. And so it is not unusual for someone to have, you know, like a Dansby Swanson to hit poorly for half of the season or better, and all of a sudden he's hitting like Dansby Swanson used to hit.
Well, also, they're starting to get some...
And I don't even think he's there yet. Think he's, you know, he's starting to hit for average and getting on base a lot more, but he hasn't even started into the power yet, and he probably will at some point. So that gives them a chance to be a playoff contender, and I think that would be good. I think they were interesting at the trade deadline too, because I think it looked like their attitude was, I'm trading for next season. I don't want prospects that are in Class A ball. I want if I'm getting prospects, I want prospects that I might actually see on my roster. If not later this season, I'll see them next season. And they also traded for some guys who have, you know, a few years left before they can get to free agency, and they have some talent, and they need to work on them. One of them was the reliever who finished out the game last night. He needs work. He needs coaching because he's got a live arm. But they did all of this. But I think it also made their team better this year. I mean, the only guy they're really going to miss a lot that they traded is Leiter.
Yeah, maybe. I thought that guy Biggie was pretty close.
But I don't think they're going to miss him, not this year.
No. I mean, it was pretty interesting. I don't know if you watched the last couple nights. I made it to seventh inning. Joe Girardi gives you an interesting view, different than, I don't know where DeShays has been, but Girardi's been in the booth doing the color, and he says, this is not, this whole idea that you see in all the tweets and everything about how there's buyers and sellers, he goes, With the new playoff picture, there's only like five teams that are out of the playoffs. Because you're not going to see this wholesale buying and selling. People are using the deadline as a way to help their team this year and going forward. It's almost like off season. Because there's a barrier there in terms of a deadline. So you're going to see some more movement than normal. He said, but it's not this wholesale buying or selling where if you're not going to make the playoffs, you know, half the teams are just getting rid of people, and the other halves are picking up people. Because that's not the deal now. Because there's only like, I think he said five teams that are really out of it. He says, so the Cubs are trying, to improve their team this year going forward. And they think they did with this third baseman. And they did a little, he goes, with Leiter, they got somebody for him. Because these are sort of like regular trades. They're not really the definition of the old school buying and selling. I mean, do you agree with that?
I agree with that. I agree that they were looking at building their team, and if it's not going to happen for them this year, they understood that. I don't think they had any delusions of grandeur. I think they just looked at it and said, we have an opportunity now because there is demand for some of our guys. We have an opportunity now to improve our team as we go into next season. And if in the meantime we happen to get hot and make it this year, we haven't done anything to eliminate that possibility.
Well, I mean, I think with Morrell, I mean, I really like the kid. He wasn't really improving that much at the plate, but his natural position, if there is one, is second base, and he's not moving Horner out of there. And he was kind of a butcher at third. So they got a third baseman.
I don't know that I'd call second base a natural position for him either.
It's his best position.
Over the year, it might be his best position, but that doesn't mean he was good at it.
Well, we got to dash here to Russell. Talk to you on Friday. We got all kinds of stuff between now and Friday. Just think how much news there's going to be, Kevin. What is your? Do you have any any clue, because I do not. Right. Ron Insano was on the other day on the TV. Something's behind this Japanese yen doing this all over the place. 2-3% moves in a currency. Kevin, you don't want to be trading that stuff with a 2-3% move. I mean, that's...
No, I don't think so. I did hear something where they said whatever actions they were planning to take on the currency, you know, rate-wise, that their central bank has just put all of that on hold and they're not going to do anything. I don't know what impact that has because I haven't been following that closely enough to really know what they're not doing because I didn't know what they were going to do.
Well, that's... All right, we're going to dash off the road. You want to go a real quick break and then we'll bring Russell on? Or do you want to just go right to him, Andrew? What's up to you, bud?
Sure. If Russell's ready, we can bring him right on.
Russell's ready. Russell, how are you, buddy?
I'm here. I'm ready, apparently. What's going on?
Well,
Happy Wednesday.
You're gonna tell us the vol and the... I want to talk to you seriously about vol without getting too crazy technical, but I think people should know what the hell it is because everybody quotes the VIX and... I ever tell you I was I was an expert witness at this arbitration, right? Mm-hmm. And they were talking about volatility. So they just happened to be a young lady, and she was the head of risk at some real big firm. And she walks in and says, "Well, this is a long, crazy story. Someday I'll tell you over a cup of coffee, but it has with fingers that went anywhere. The big firm won. Imagine that, right? But it also had." Tentacles of the guy absolutely got buried on a settlement in the rut.
And oh,
the people on the other side of the trades were the people who kind of did the settlement. there could have been, if somebody would have had the money, there could have been lawsuits flying everywhere. The more I learned about this, the sneakier it got. Anyway, she comes in and she says, he starts talking about they did this to this guy because of volatility. So the attorney says to her, now when you say, there was a lot of volatility. What are you talking about? Well, she goes, well, there's a lot of volatility. And he goes, a lot compared to when? A lot compared to normal? What's normal? What's a little bit more than normal? And where does this rank?
Yeah.
And she's like, he says, well, let's start from the beginning. He goes, how would you define volatility? And this lady's the head of risk. And she goes, volatility. And he goes,
oh, my gosh.
You can't define the word by the word. It's like, sex. It's sex. No, what is it? Anyway, of course they had the best attorneys. They ended up winning, but when you talk about, I've had some adult beverages with some people in the last couple of weeks regarding, the VIX and so forth. And I mean, you're already expert on the VIX, but it comes down to, nothing's changed since 1987. Or even before that, when people go for insurance in the market, they're looking to buy insurance, essentially buy puts, which is what you're doing. It's like buying insurance on cars. It's like nobody in this area ever needed fire insurance, and all of a sudden, oops, there's a forest fire next door, and everybody wants it. I mean, who's going to sell it to you? There's a very finite group of sellers, and I've kind of known, just anecdotally, now I don't see everybody's sheets, I don't see anybody's sheets, that there's been a stress factor and some of these big liquidity providers, meaning the people who are left that make markets. And what happens is, and I know this unfortunately very well from 1987, is you have people, you buy puts, meaning you're buying insurance, and so I'll sell you 50. I'll sell you another 50. And all of a sudden, I can only sell, say, 200-300 at all. It doesn't matter what the price is. And all of a sudden, the VIX in times of panic or the implied volatility is not linear. It could take forever to get from 15 to 25. It can go from 25 to 30 and 30 to 70 in like a minute, because all of a sudden people just, in a lot of these firms now, you know it's probably better than me, if their risk is too high, they get fined by their clearing firm. Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew there were penalties around that.
So
I actually think that's a pretty good idea.
Well, so today, if say the spiders are,
you want the clearing firm wants you to keep your house in order, so they don't have to.
But thing of it is, if you and I are managing, CalPERS or someplace, who knows? I mean, say there's something that's a. By the way, you and I would be very capable of doing it.
That's right.
If all of a sudden somebody has a $2 billion portfolio, and I'm trying to do the math in my head here, and a lot of it's in the spiders or in S&P 500 stocks, and they go, hey, you two guys, you two knuckleheads, Russell and Chief, we want to put a floor under this. You know, even if it's a panic floor, things trade in 527, and we go, you know, how panicky? Well, anything below like 20% we can't handle. All right, so we're essentially going to buy the 480 or 485 puts. But because we're talking about, you know, $20 billion, we're talking about a boatload of these puts, right? Well, now, who the hell exactly is going to insure the market to us if we've got $50 billion? I mean, they probably will do it for us. But now if somebody else does the same thing an hour from now and somebody else does another thing an hour, these 10 people are not, they're not natural insurers of the whole damn world, are they? And that's what happens. No. The first, we might actually get in for a pretty good price. But if everybody sees us do it, the next guy is going to go, wait a minute. not only am I not selling at that price, I'm a buyer at that price to get this crap back, right?
Yeah, there's a great scene in Margin Call where the CEO of whatever firm it's supposed to be says there's three ways to make money, and you know, one was cheat. We know nobody cheats. We're certain of that.
Yeah.
Be smarter than everybody else. There are a lot of smart people in the markets. Or be first. And first is really what you want to. And I really think that everybody got surprised. And that you know, we know about, and we talk about this all the time on the show, that people, you know things are overvalued. You know that there are lots of fissures all over the world right now that could just, you know, create big problems, including the Japanese yen. You know, and you know those things are in the background, but none of them have been causing issues or coming true or anything else. So there's a lot of complacency in the market. I felt like we were due for some sort of pullback, but I didn't think it was going to happen, you know, Friday and Monday. We just had the Fed meeting. They said we're ready to maybe start cutting, and then you get a number of an employment number that basically confirms, yeah, they need to cut, and not only do they need to cut 25 basis points, they need to cut 50 now. I'm really surprised that Fed cutting more than the market was expecting this time last week, that is what has caused the stock market to come under pressure.
Well, Dan,
because all we've been talking about and all we've been thinking is, well, the stock market is staying up because it's anticipating that rates are going to start to get cut. And now that it's staring us in the face, the stock market doesn't like it because it's going to be too aggressive.
Well, I mean, the interesting, every time, of course, I'm not going to do it because I want it. Every time somebody gets on TV and crows about we want this rate cut. I had the thing up here. I'll try and remember. We started this in May of 2022, but we were 0.5%. We went up to 5%.
Yeah.
Now, whenever if you had a student and he would say, well, if all we have to do is start cutting rates and the market will be okay, the implication to you and everybody else would be, since we started raising rates, the market has gone down because of that, and all we have to do is reverse it and we should be okay. The only problem with that is the market's up 25% since they started.
Yeah.
So where's the bad here that I'm missing? I mean,
That's the thing right there. That's been my deal with the Fed cutting rates is they're not going to do it because they can. They're going to do it because they think they need to.
Yeah.
You know, and the last thing everybody that pays attention to business can spend hours criticizing the Fed.
Well, that's what we do as a national sport.
But apparently they've done a fairly okay job so far.
Well, I mean,
the economy's running okay. You know, unemployment's up a bit, but you know, are we saying that you were talking about the lady being the professional witness. You know, can you tell me what is a high unemployment number and a low unemployment number? Well, but, you know, 4.3% is really not a bad employment number. Now, I know it's higher than where we were, but our unemployment number, but I know it's higher than where we were, but it's not, you know, in the long term context of things, it's really not such a bad number.
Well,
now,
but also,
I think that number's getting ready to go up.
What do you when you teach class, what do you say about the unemployment number? My first class ever at Notre Dame, the guy said the unemployment number is worthless. And that was kind of the end of that. Because it's always been worthless, and I mean, I guess it's not necessarily worthless, but it's how do you dovetail it with the whole column of, I mean, let's put it this way. Out of 105 million people that aren't working,
mm-hmm.
the unemployment number is out of that 105 million, the people that are allegedly looking for a job. How the hell?
Yeah, you're actively in the workplace. You know, you're actively in the workplace
because you're looking for a job. But how do you even know who the hell that is? I mean, in the last month,
because you call up and you say, you know, are you? But my understanding is the survey is basically, are you working? You know, and if you're not working, are you actively seeking a job? How long have you been actively seeking a job? And I believe, don't quote me on this one, I believe after 6 months you're considered not in the workforce anymore.
Well, that's because I think
if you don't go from one job to another.
Well, I think that I'll use the term, I won't say lazy, even though I already did. Mm-hmm. I think what they're doing now is that now, I've been here for a long time. If you, and this isn't going to happen, if Indiana decides to lay everybody off, which I sure as I hope they don't, or my place, you and I are on unemployment for what's the normal if there's no 26 weeks? I'm not sure what it is. When does the state?
I guess it is. I've been unemployed, but I've never received unemployment before.
When we all got booted from Pullman, I did for mm-hmm. about a month. And then I went back and said I got another job, but I was working for, it was Uncle Jim Thompson. I was working for Uncle Jim at the time. He was sending me a check. But I think what happens, Russell, is when our unemployment stuff runs out, they say we're not looking anymore.
Yeah.
So that's their convenient.
Yeah, there's
way
a point, and that's what I feel like where you're going with this is instead of that 4.3% number or the jobs created number. You want to take a look at how many people are in the workforce and how many of those people are working.
Right.
And there's, you know, you really do have to start to dig deeper into the numbers to get the useful pieces of information. The headline number is really not the most important, the most important thing that people are looking at when they're slicing and dicing that number. Just like when you look at earnings from a company, you see the earnings per share number, but yeah, you'll see a good earnings per share number and the stock trades off. Well, that's because there's a lot of stuff inside that report that people don't like.
Well, if you, if we have enough different points of view, not necessarily points of view, but different expertises on the show, that if you kind of pick up the pieces from a lot of the people who are on, and not just me, what I try and do is draw the knowledge out of the guests, because I tell you what, I'm so proud to have the people I have on the show, for God's sake. But if you look at the, Carl always digs into the weird stuff with the numbers where you actually have hourly wages going up, but weekly paychecks going down, which means mm-hmm. people are being cut hours. Now, that's not what you're going to hear on TV, because that's, you know, it's cold water on a party or something. But the thing that I think is, Nancy was on 2 weeks ago, I don't know if you were listening to Russell, she was talking about she's trying to get a mortgage for this guy, and the guy's, he's working, but he's somewhere between 20 and 30 hours. So he's guaranteed 20, most of the time works 30, but he's always in a situation where if they need him another day, they don't have to pay overtime. You know, that's sort of the drill, which is kind of screwed up. And you look at the big numbers, the establishment stuff, and I've said this a few times, but I think it's kind of important. You look at the establishment numbers that come out every month. In the last year, I mean, I'm mentally adding it up, you're probably better. I'm going to say we're 2.5 to 3 million jobs essentially created, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there. It's been roughly 220 a month for the last year. Now last month was less, but we've had a couple 295s too, right? So
yeah.
Now you look at that. Now those jobs include if I'm delivering pizzas at night, and you call the pizza joint up, they're going to say they've got me working, and by the way, so is PTI going to say I'm working. So there's two. But now if you call my house, if I had a wife, she or whoever was there, the cleaning lady picks up the phone and goes, yeah, he's working. It counts as one. So there's a difference between the surveys. If you look at the household survey, in July of last year, we had 161,209,000 working. This year, we have 161,266,000. So we're up 50,000, not 3 million.
And, yeah.
So if you and I, since we're in good moods this morning, if we're going to say that the government's just not flat-ass lying to us, the only way both of those numbers could be correct is we just created three million people that now have two jobs.
Right? I can see that. I could totally see that.
And what other explanation could there be unless...
I basically have two jobs.
Yeah.
But nobody's gonna
call the consulting firm or the editor that you're writing at whatever, or the book you're writing. I mean, they're not gonna call that person probably.
Right.
But here's the number I think we sort of gotta keep. I mean, I'm not a labor scholar, but if I could have 20 minutes in one of your classes, and I'd have to bring Carl with me. Here's the number that's kind of that I think is weird. We start out the year with 5.9 million unemployed, in other words, in the workforce looking for work, and we have 99.9 that are essentially we don't know what they're doing. Students, they're retired, they're eating bonbons on the sofa, whatever it is. Now, a year later, we've got 7.1 million unemployed, meaning looking for a job. We also have 100 million in this other column. And I think the number that's kind of key here, Russell, and I don't know how you deal with it. We had 60.4% of the people that could be working were working, and now we're down to 60. I think every one of those tenth of a point is all of a sudden people that aren't contributing into the system, and people maybe taking it out of the system. I'm not saying if you retire and you get your Social Security, you're taken out of the system because you paid in. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. But that number, I think for us to be healthy, needs to be, it used to be in 2006, it was 63. And now we're down to 60. So I don't really care if they're unemployed or not. I think we need 63% of the population available to work to be actually working, and that's 60. I can't imagine what we're going to look like if it goes down to 55. How are we going to balance anything?
We're not. No, I mean, you're going to end up with a pretty bad demographic situation there. So, and beyond what you're talking about right there, as far as the actual number of jobs and everything, we have a lot of people that are coming to this country. And if we're really not creating jobs for them, what are they doing?
Well, they're waiting in the street looking for a job.
I mean, they're either going to be, you can automatically be taken out of context. So I'm choosing my words very carefully. If you've got the reason that you come to the United States, I think, is for economic opportunity. I really can't, get into the mind of people that. But I assume that things are so desperate where they are, they're going to walk across a country to try to get in here. Maybe this is what Trump was trying to say when he used the phrase black jobs. I don't know.
I don't see how, and what
he really meant was blue collar jobs, and he just said it that way, which was terrible.
I've worked in blue collar places, and the idea, I knew welders that were the most well read people you ever talked to.
This is
a skill. I mean, but whenever I bring up the immigration thing, I don't want to cause, but I would not, if I reopened Tilden Tech High School. I always use that because my cousin went there. And so did Johnny Kerr, by the way. Remember the late, great Johnny Kerr, the announcer? If I open that, it's not like I wouldn't want all any... There's got to be all kinds of adults around here of every color and creed that would like to have some training and get one of these jobs that's available. I would love to. I mean, God, if I could stop the world for a while and become a gazillionaire, I would love to have a railroad production and streetcar production place here in Chicago that would employed, 1,500 people that did refitting and did new cars and did everything, and talk about inner city transportation and go back to some really unique streetcar routes and things like that. I'd love to redo the whole place. That's always been my passion, Russell, as much as I love trading.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would love to have two schools. I don't care what the hell you look like, what color you are. If you want to learn to be a welder or something at my place, there is a school. Go get there in 6 months from now or a year or 2 years from now. Come on over here and you're hired the first day. That's the America I want to see. And by the way, if you're a welder and we sit on break and we talk about the Japanese yen on break, that's all the better, right? I mean, right? It doesn't mean you got to be a dummy to be a welder, does it? I mean, I'm not a dummy.
Not at all. Not. And in fact, there are a lot of, we've had things where our basement flooded. So we've got a stream of people coming in and out of our house that were giving checks as they walk out the door to. They do things. I consider myself a fairly smart guy. They do all kinds of things that I would not trust me doing.
I just heard something.
I can change a light bulb, but I probably sell myself a bit short on things like that. I can install a ceiling fan or do some, those kind of things. But
gotta hate doing that. There's a million parts.
I wouldn't want me down trying to repair all the flood damage from my in my basement. That's beyond my capabilities. There are different types of intelligence. Like they say, professional athletes see things develop almost in slow motion compared to the rest of us.
Yep. Did I ever tell you my ceilings?
People that work the hands are a lot more talented at doing things than I could ever be.
What was somebody's commencement address, if you ever give one? This guy gave a commencement address, or a lady, I don't know what it was. The quote was, just remember, everybody else in the world knows something that you don't.
Yeah.
Ever tell you my 30-second ceiling fan story?
No.
My guy who worked for me, he was my assistant forever, and unfortunately he passed. He says, Chief, you're pretty good at this electric stuff, aren't you? Well, I was before. Now I'm not so sure I'd trust myself, but he goes, how long does it take to put in three ceiling fans? And I go, his name was Mike Jansy. I go, Jansy, they're a royal pain in the ass. They got a million parts.
Yeah.
But you know what? We'll work our way through it. No big deal. And he goes, well, if you come out over like 9, when should I order the beer and the pizzas? I go, if you got one that has a million parts, it might take us an hour a fan to do it right, so say 12 o'clock. So I walk in and I look in the bedroom and I go, hey, where's the ceiling box? And we don't have any of those. Like, oops.
Oh, they didn't even have a light fixture ahead of time?
Well, they had, code for those that don't know. You either need a light in a bedroom, all right, or one of the outlets, and you can split them off. One of the outlets has to be worked by there has to be a switch when you enter a room you can turn the light on. Doesn't have to be a ceiling light. It can be one of the outlets.
Yeah.
So I go, he goes, well, can we do that? And I go, we can do it, but it's not by 12 o'clock. So, it's up in the attic, in the insulation, putting the thing in, running the wires down, drilling
man.
Them. So yeah. we didn't even start the ceiling fans till like 2:30. His wife's going, hey, these pizzas are cold. I'm going, they're going to get colder. They're going to get a lot colder. Hey, what do you say we go to break? We come back. I've been waiting for you all week. You're going to explain what in God's name is going on with this Japanese yen. 2-3%. That is, I can't imagine being a yen trader and all of a sudden my 50 delta options are all 100 delta. There's got to be some blood in that pit. SP futures up 58, NASDAQ futures up 238, and some real happy people as well in that pit. There's somebody's got the other side. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed-income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we have always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Owl. We've got Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 59, NASDAQ Futures up 250. We're trying to do what we were trying to do yesterday, and then we kind of gave up half of it, or maybe a little more than half of it on the close. Now we're right back up here to kind of our highs of yesterday, so we'll see if we hang in there today or go higher. We won't know until a little later. We'll see it when we see it, as they say. The Dow Futures are up, as soon as my machine gets together here, up to 292. Individual stocks in the Dow, I've got Caterpillar up 5. It was up 13 yesterday after earnings. Goldman Sachs up 8. For some reason, we'll get Russell's opinion on this. Microsoft's back up 8, too. They made back a lot of what they lost. The banks were all up pretty heavy yesterday. Now, does that mean the Fed's going to give them even more money or something? That's being a little snide, but we'll ask Russell that as well. We're in Europe. These guys didn't bounce back hardly at all yesterday, but they're doing it today. DAX up 198, that's 1.1%. FTSE up 92, 1.1%. CAC around leading the pack, up 105, 1.5%. We're in Asia. Nikkei up 414, 1.2%, 35,098. They've made back most of that 12% loss the other day. It's 12% losses are not normal. They're not healthy. I guess the bounce back is healthier, but still, it's not a usual situation. Hang Seng up 230, it's 1.4%. Still can't make it to 17,000 yet. 16,877, maybe tomorrow. Shanghai up 2, which is nothing. 28,69, and they don't seem to be going anywhere. Again, yesterday, Dow was up 294. S&P's up 53. They were up over 100 most of the day. Like I said, gave some of that back. NASDAQ up 166. I'm going to say they were in the mid-200s up most of the day. They gave some of that back, but now they're getting a lot of it is higher again today. 10-year up 5 basis points, 3.94. It got down to like 3.7, I think. The Bund up 9 basis points, 2.28. Japan, and this is what we're going to talk about, at 0.89. Oil, rallying, but from a real low number, up 188 to 75.08. I think they ducked into the 72s a couple days ago. Brent up 178, 78.26. Obviously, if there's a recession, people use less gasoline. Natural gas up 8 cents, 2.09. RBOB up 2 cents, 2.35. Gold, a little bit of a rally, up 1070. 2442. Now, when I say 2442, I'm talking about the December contract. The August contract is 2392. So there's a $50 premium in the future, as you would expect. But the cash is closer to 2400. Silver down 2 cents, 2719. Copper down 4 cents, 398. FX, US against dollar against the euro, 109, pretty steady. British pound against the dollar, 127.2, pretty steady. However, another 2% move here in the yen, is the yen is now 147, so it's weakening. Got down to 143, and it's up to 147, it's weakening. Remember, the yen is done the other way. When I say euro, it's euro is worth $1.09. Okay, now the yen is a different way. It takes 146 yen to make a dollar, so it's a little confusing. Crypto, up 415, 57,154. We're Wednesday and Monday morning, it traded under 50, so it's bounced back 7,000 there. Andrew, what do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
All right, it is 7:36 here in Chicago on Wednesday, August 7th. Starting off a little bit of sports here, the Cubs won over the Twins 7-3. The White Sox won over the Athletics 5-1, ending their 21-game losing streak. And then finally, the Diamondbacks were going to play the Guardians yesterday, but that was postponed due to some rain. That's going to be played today. It's going to be a doubleheader later today, Diamondbacks against the Guardians. Over to Chicago weather, it's currently 72 degrees. We're going to have a high of 77 today. Should be breezy and pleasant throughout the day with a mix of both clouds and sunshine. Over in Phoenix, they are at 82 degrees. A little bit of the same deal. Sunny, but a little bit clouds here and there. They're going to have a high of 105 today. Currently at 82. I don't know if I said that already. And then finally, over to Chicago traffic. Looks like if you're on the inbound, traffic is building, especially if you're coming in from the north side. If you're coming in from the north or the west, the Eisenhower and the Kennedy are looking a bit heavier on the inbound. It looks like this just popped up. This is on the inbound Kennedy. This is east between Foster Avenue and Central Avenue. It is closed due to an accident. Let's see, looks like it's suggesting solid traffic and to expect delays up to 5 minutes.
I'd turn back if I were you, play golf.
That's right. But other than that, things are looking pretty okay, especially if you're on the outbound. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, a couple of questions. One, you got to explain this whole Japanese yen thing. But the other is, how did somebody, and again, you and I do never give market advice, but given this entire fiasco with this CrowdStrike / Microsoft and Delta One and all these, everybody's going to be piling in here legally, whether they win or they lose, who the hell knows, but how did somebody come out yesterday with all that in your face and recommend CrowdStrike? I could never recommend anything.
You know, they probably have an investment banking relationship with, I don't know who recommended them, but they probably have some sort of investment banking relationship with those guys and want to help them out. So they say, look, in the long run, this is all going to work itself out. We're not 100% sure how, but it you know, the fundamentals of the company are still strong with the exception of one little glitch
that
affected the world.
I just did a section on distressed hedge funds that look at distressed companies and try to figure out what the valuations are when and this is not exactly the same as what's going on with CrowdStrike, but a big part of the deal if you're involved in buying securities of distressed companies or companies that are going through a restructuring is understanding the how long is it going to take for the restructuring, what kind of return are some of the debtors going to get. I haven't seen what they said about CrowdStrike, but if my job were to be the analyst that covered the company, I would get with a couple of I'd get with some people at my firm or maybe even a couple of clients that specialize in this stuff and go, okay, what is the valuation based on best case, worst case, middle scenario with respect to the litigation, but also is CrowdStrike going to be negatively impacted as the litigation goes on? Are people trying to figure out how they can not use them for anything anymore? And if customers are sticking with them because they don't have any other choices, and you can run the numbers on what this is ultimately going to cost them, you can come up with a valuation where the stock should be attractive. You're making, but and it's just like, we mentioned IBM, so I can say this because and people know this is not a recommendation, but. IBM, it's the equivalent of the kind of analysis that you would do if you're going to, maybe if you're a sell-side analyst and you recommend IBM, check around with a couple of their customers, check with the company how their numbers are doing, and, with respect to CrowdStrike, you can check everything out and figure out where the value is, and typically in a lot of these situations, things do overshoot to the downside. So it is kind of a safe recommendation if you think.
Well,
about
you're
it.
Right. If you don't know how many of the customers saying, I don't know how the hell these guys got involved.
I mean, that's what I would be doing. I mean, that's exactly what I would be doing. And that's what if I were still on the buy side, and I keep throwing that term around. Back when I worked at a hedge fund, the analyst that what firm was it that recommended CrowdStrike?
I'm not sure. Whoever
it is, if I have a relationship with that brokerage firm, I'm gonna
talk to my sales guy, I might talk to the analyst, and some of the things that I just said are the types of things that I would ask that analyst. I have to say, you know, does it look like, you know, are there going to be some secondary impacts where people are looking around to get rid of CrowdStrike? Is it too expensive to get rid of them? Buffett's thesis on buying, and I know I jumped right back to IBM, but this was his thesis behind IBM, was that they had a lot of captured clients because you know, they put these big servers on site, and the cost of changing to one of the one or two competitors that you had a choice among, you know, that's why he liked IBM. They had they basically had a moat around their business. He didn't foresee the cloud changing the way that that type of computing works. It's not to criticize him or anything, but it's just to point out what I would be looking at with respect to CrowdStrike. What I hope they're looking at with respect to CrowdStrike is, you know, are the customers going to stick with them? Do they have to stick with them? I don't know that much about the technology behind what they do. I just know that whatever it is, it's very important, and they should be careful when they do updates.
Well, Carl was all over. I mean, he, you know, he knows a hell of a lot more about this than I do, obviously. And he was just convinced that those guys, you know, they have this. They shouldn't be everywhere, and everybody should just take them and put them everywhere. That somehow or another, you know, they it's become so. I'll let him talk about it on Friday, but it has to do with it's in places that you shouldn't have to be in. You know, these things don't have to be hooked up to the internet, and they are. And if you are, you know, that sort of thing. But I was looking at IBM because we do, the only time I really look at all this stuff for us, so I'm the first one to admit that we have all kinds of stocks here that we watch, but the reason why I watch them is because clients bring them in, right? I mean, yeah. I'm way more of a, because I was an OEX trader for 20 years, I'm much more comfortable putting somebody in the Spiders or the Qs or the Russell, whichever they want. Or my brother's got a lot of people that really are in the XLV, which is the medical part of the market. There's all these ETFs where you can pick your spots, yeah. Right? But I would much rather put somebody in the XLE oil-wise and try and pick the best oil company, because that's just not, you know, if I pick the best one or I pick the worst one, you know what? One could happen as easy as the other, you know, type of thing. It's just not my mm-hmm. my job. But IBM, I watch these earnings plays all the time, and for several years, the stock did nothing but surprise to the downside. And I don't yeah. follow. Now all of a sudden, every earnings thing that they're sort of surprised to the upside here, and they're up to, you know, kind of their highs. And I wonder if
they're getting it, back together.
I wonder if somehow they're getting it back together. I mean, I don't know, but right now I don't really want to fade them on these earnings things, because the last couple they've been pretty good. All right, hey, what's going on with the yen? How the hell does something trade? I was looking at a number here in 2023. It says 70 some billion dollars a day trade yen to dollars, like every day. It's got to be more than that. It's got to be more than that now. So it's a big market. What?
The currency markets are, you know, currency and government debt are huge compared to stocks. People don't really realize that. No, it looks like they kind of got, you know, they're raising rates.
Sort of. They're 1%.
Yeah, well, still, but it's all relative. You know, it's go back to your professional witness who couldn't define volatility, whether it was high or low. You know, it's the kind of the same thing there. You know, is this a lot of volatility or not a lot of volatility? It's for currency, it is a lot of volatility.
I'm going to say 3% is more than I've ever seen, except them devaluing the peso or something.
Yeah, I forgot where this conversation was going on, but I don't know if it was last week, us talking about the central banks just not talking. This was on a different podcast I heard, just that it seems like the central banks don't work together as well as they used to in the past.
Well, for the whole thing of COVID and the whole mess, they were so together, it was like they were the same place. You and I talked about it. You and I talked about it last week. It seemed like the communication is breaking down a little. Doesn't it?
Yeah. No, it most definitely is. But it's just with respect to the yen, their rates are going up, And, you know, that happened last week. That's totally fine. And then all of a sudden, you get some weak numbers in the U.S., and, you know, if we sneeze, everybody catches a cold or whatever. So now the Bank Japan's kind of in a funny situation where they felt like they needed to raise rates, but globally it looks like, you know, other central banks are going to start cutting rates, and those cut it's just wreaking havoc with their currency, where currency looked attractive because, you know, relatively higher rate. Now are they going to be able to hold that or not? And because there's so much uncertainty with respect to what their central bank is going to do next, and have they made some mistakes, it's just absolutely pummeling their stocks. And you mentioned that I think you mentioned that the financials were really heavy. I think that's the sector that was by far the weakest over in Japan with the sell-off that they had.
But here our guys are going straight up. Here the financials are going straight up. Last few days.
I thought you said that they felt kind of heavy.
No, I'm saying that J.P. Morgan yesterday and the day before, or J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs have gone flying up here the last couple of days.
Oh, okay. Right.
What the? How big? How can I estimate? How big is the quote carry trade? I was trying to explain it to everybody yesterday, that it's borrowing money at one place at a low interest rate, and then investing it in another place. But the trade is you can't go to. You can go to Europe and borrow dollars, right? You can borrow, because there are dollar deposits in European banks. But I don't think there's the equivalent. Are there dollar deposits in Japanese banks? In other words, if I want to go borrow in Japan, I have to borrow yen, and then I have to turn them into dollars, and I'm paying 1% or something, right? So now I take the dollars that I just converted over here, and I invest, say, in a T-bill at 5% if I just want to be lame, and I'm making the 4, except for the part that in order for me to make the 4, I got to go back to Japan and convert the dollars into the yen, hopefully at the same price. Operative word there being hopefully.
Well, you have to lock that conversion in ahead of time.
Good. If you do, you don't make any money.
Yeah. Well, you do, but you don't make. It's like you're not making. You threw out there, you know, 5% versus 1%. You're making a handful of basis points. You're not making that big difference. And what you do is you lock in a forward rate, and you know, a forward rate where you're going to be able to, let's just say we want to earn the Japanese rate and lock in the conversion from yen back to dollars at some point in the future. You should be able to do that, and you should be able to do that at a rate that ends up being higher than what you can borrow at in the United States right now.
Well, if you're doing if you're doing something risk-free there and risk-free here, which I would say a T-bill is, so if I'm borrowing at 1 and I'm lending it to the government here at 5, isn't my forward, if I want to buy the yen back on a forward next year, isn't the difference going to be 4%?
It's going to be close, but there are opportunities to do a little bit to basically scalp 10 or 20 basis points.
But I'm not getting a whole 4%.
No. Yeah, that's where I'm trying to go. But you're doing that, and if you're doing something like that, you're borrowing the money here, and then you're investing it elsewhere. So, you know, you're trying to make money off of the spread and the earning the interest outside the United States in a different currency. You take the money, you borrow the money here, you convert it to yen, you make the interest off of the yen, and then you repatriate it at some point in the future where you have locked in a forward contract to do so. And by going through all of that whole process right there, you're able to, with other people's money, you know, maybe just make 10 or 20 basis points off of a very high number. It starts to fall apart when you can't lock in the forward exchange rate anymore in a favorable way.
Spoken like a true professor, in the words of our buddies of the Jag Note guys, remember them? Anthony?
Yeah,
remember those guys?
I remember them.
The one guy said, hey, Russell, have some Cayunes. Borrow at 1%, lend it out at 5, and just assume you're going to be able to get the end back where you got it. Just, yeah. Screw that forward contract. That's for pigeons, right?
Well, and then you did ask how big it is.
Yeah.
And the answer 5 or 10 years ago would have been, I have no freaking clue, and I don't know how to find out. But now so many over the counter derivatives are now centrally cleared, that there probably is a place to find that. And when I get the machines up and running this morning, I'll do a little digging on that.
Turn those machines back on.
Yes.
Turn those. There's been a Duke on this floor for, so turn those machines back on.
We founded this exchange.
Yeah. we talked a little bit. We're not predicting anything, Russell or I. We're just pointing things out, and I mentioned just through anecdotal conversations, if you would have asked me a week ago, what do you think of the potential of risk exploding more than normal? I mean, when I said, or with the VIX, I would have said, if you would have asked me that question last Wednesday, gee, Russell, with these few conversations I've had with people, they're struggling to not pay these fines to the clearing firms every night, because they're constantly being... People want to buy, you know, 20,000 calls on the VIX at the 20 level, or want to buy, you know, some people are buying, you know, the gold ETF is GLD, right? It's trading 222. There's people who want to buy, you know, 20,000 of the 250s for like November or January, just in case the world goes to pot, and somebody has to sell those, and you end up with tremendous. I'll use the term naked calls or puts. They're far enough away where you're not sort of worried about it, but there's minimums on all these things, and then there's penalties. So even these firms that seem like they're really big, I mean, even Citadel has a number, right, that they're not just going to sell. And I'm starting to get a sense that these guys are a little bit stressed. I never would have dreamed that the VIX would, like, double in one day like it did. Where'd it go to, like, 55 or something? Yet,
oh, it hit 65 yesterday, but
But you and I know how it works.
It hit 65 during a very illiquid time,
right? But
so
it,
I don't know how it's great.
But I'm saying that the stress level here, I think, is a little higher than people think it is. And I
don't know if it's the stress level as much. People are not prepared for some sort of sell off like they probably should be. And I'll be completely. I've been net short most of the year, personally, and I was not as short as I've been most of the year, Friday and Monday.
And neither were we. Neither were we. Are you ever the most short the day it goes down?
I just did not. I really didn't think that August was going to be the month.
Yeah, I didn't either.
And I don't know why, because August has been the month in the past. We had a Chinese stock market, a ridiculous sell-off once in August that rippled around the rest of the world. I feel like I'm talking about something for like 15 years ago, though. So I don't know. I felt like we were going to have a very, very interesting fall with the U.S. elections. You know, the Fed starting to cut rates. I felt like that's when we were going to see a lot of the market volatility, not in August. So, surprise.
Well, I'll say it so you don't have to. I think the idea that no matter what the market wants to do, no matter what stocks you may feel or don't feel are, by the way, there's a quote in this book that I saw last night, and I can't find it, having to do with only a few stocks. This is 1929. Only a few stocks are going way up, and the stocks that seem to be actually have earnings aren't going up. So, and it's amazing how that was 95 years ago, and people sound the same. People don't change, do they? It's all about margin. It's all about greed. It's all about whatever. And but aren't you? We're at somewhat of a high level. But why does I mean? And our buddy Goolsbee, who's now the chairman of the Chicago Fed, came out like, was it yesterday morning or the day before that? Don't worry. The Fed will save the market. Where does he get off saying that? I mean, anybody really thinks that no matter how bad the world gets, if they drop a 0.75 point, we're all okay? Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from they've kind of taken care of us for a while now, haven't they? I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah, I think it's does too.
This impression that they have been, you know, taking care of us forever.
Well, where do you stand? So, and if you don't want to mention it, don't. I really do believe, I hope I'm wrong, that the Fed allegedly has this dual mandate for full employment and low inflation, low to no inflation. Actually, it's supposed to be none, but they've redefined it to 2%.
They want a small amount of inflation.
Well,
they want it, you know, for the basic economic idea that, you know, if prices are not going to go up in the future, that you're not going to have as much consumption. Well, I don't know how much I believe. I don't know if I've ever really believed that.
I think a big part
of everybody's daily consumption is stuff that doesn't make a difference. You're not thinking about your next paycheck when you get lunch or when I order my DoorDash or things like that, you know? So I don't know how much I agree with the whole inflation makes inflation helps spur economic activity because you want to buy something today because you're afraid it might be more expensive tomorrow. I've never really gotten on board.
Russell, I'm going to take a stab at this, and you can use it in class or you can tell me I'm all wet. I'm going to say, if you go back to when I was very young, you look at the world in the 60s and early 70s. Yeah, mm-hmm. I won't go so far to early 70s because the Vietnam War started to screw that up. But say the late 50s and the 60s, you had an economic... You didn't want to be alive then unless you... Because if you got sick, you were pretty much screwed, right? God help you if you had heart or cancer problems. Or you had a cavity at a level to pull your tooth. So it wasn't the world's... But in terms of economics, it had to be the absolute panacea of the world. Inflation was roughly 2%, I'm going to say. Uh-huh. But the average person was getting a raise of probably 3%.
That's a perfect world, isn't it?
I mean, I know when my mother and my stepfather bought our original house in 1958, you know, my mom had saved up some money, even though she was, you know, a widow. So they put down a down payment. I'm going to say in 2 years, the mortgage was probably half. My stepfather got some promotions. Probably half of one paycheck, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, so the house went up, you know, 2% a year. He was making 3%, plus he was getting promoted, so he's probably making more like 8 or 10% a year raise. And there was this thing going on, but it's almost like a dead body. Okay, you look at a dead body and you say, well, what should we start first? You know, if we can get him breathing, well, how the hell is he going to breathe if the brain doesn't tell him to breathe? And, oh, by the way, the brain's not going to do anything if the heart's not working. And, oh, by the way, and what if somebody says, well, we'll just get them pooping again? Well, okay, maybe that'll help. But the idea that they pick out this 2% inflation as being something that's important, why not say 3% income raise? So, but the point is everybody was getting, I'm going to say, 1.5% real income raise per year. I mean, now when they say 2% inflation, oh, by the way, they lie about the number, it's really 4 or 5. Nobody's getting a 4 or 5% raise. I mean, there are people that get promoted and so forth, yes, but the whole thing isn't working like it did in the 60s. They're picking out one thing, right? Not the whole mess. I mean, if people are making 4% raise every year, I'm going to say 3% inflation's okay. But if people aren't getting a raise, 2%'s not so hot, is it?
No.
I mean,
it's all relative around that. So, yeah, my reasoning behind the do we really need the inflation is, you know, they had no price changes in Japan for decades, and to the point where certain prices of certain items were like associated with them almost like name brands.
Okay.
Because it's something that costing, you know, because a Diet Coke would cost, I know 50 yen would be, it would cost 100 yen. You know, that a soft drink has been 100 yen for
many people's lifetimes, and their economy's done pretty good, regardless, you know, even though they're having a lot of volatility right now. I think people's day-to-day lives in Japan are probably pretty nice.
When was the last time you were there? We got a day show about when was the last time you were there?
What's the last time I was in Japan? It was before COVID.
Okay, because one of our cub reporters, he's been on the show a couple times, was there maybe 4 months ago. So all everybody's doing is bitching about how prices are going up and nobody's getting a raise.
Yep, and that's a first. That's something they have not experienced in.
Well, they're not happy about
really
it.
A lot of people's lifetimes.
They're not happy about it.
Oh, I'm sure they aren't. Yeah.
All right, 20-second dog report, or else by
dog report. Latte is Latte, the little baby one that we've been fostering. She is available for adoption on the website. I will tweet out the link to that, and I'll tag Stocks and Jocks.
But they have to invite you over once a month for dinner so you can see her.
That's right. I have to. We get visitation. No, we don't get visitation. She's really. I mean, it's my I know you said 20 seconds, and I'm going long. But my youngest, who turns 18 in a couple of weeks. My wife asked, "What do you want for your birthday?" And she said, "Well, I just want to keep that dog." So
I'm betting you don't get. I'm betting you don't get rid of her.
No, we're getting rid of her. We are.
Because
We have to. She's only two. But we're going to be empty nesters in a little bit less than a year. We've got two other dogs already. We don't know. We need to go in the other direction.
God, so. I wish I could take her, but
love her to death. Really do love her to death, but she belongs in a different house too. One that has kids and people around all the time and everything. She's going to make a great kid dog.
Well, they are. Those little Frenchies love it. Those little Boston Terriers, the same way. The more scrambly, the rougher and tumble you get, the more they like it.
Yeah, they like it. I had a friend over who had a 7-year-old son who just tortured the crap out of that dog for, you know, about 10 minutes. Not in a bad way, but, you know, just playing with them like kids play with them. The dog was beautiful with him.
There you go. SP Futures up 57. NASDAQ Futures up 245. Maybe we'll actually hold this rally today. Russell, I'm going to say we have something to talk about next week. Imagine that. Have a good weekend, buddy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.